Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast number 32 for Tuesday, January 12th. My name is David Liu, and with me today are
Dominic Rabier,
Ben Snitkoff,
and David O'Brien.
We've got three more interesting stories for you today. First, the Viacom against YouTube case is ramping up. And secondly, a Missouri Court of Appeals case regarding BrowseRap and entering into license agreements through that. And finally, an interesting situation where a Chinese company is promoting a version of Ubuntu, which is made to look exactly like Windows XP. But first, we're going to start with the big case, which is Viacom versus YouTube. And so back in 2007, Viacom started a complaint against YouTube for 150,000 clips of things that Viacom owned that they found on YouTube. So Viacom is the company responsible for MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, Comedy Central, Paramount Pictures, and DreamWorks. And YouTube, of course, being the company responsible for Charlie Bit My Finger, David After Dentist, Susan Boyle, and Tay Zonday. So they said that these videos had been viewed over 1.5 billion times, and they were suing YouTube for $1 billion. So what's the most recent news on this case, guys?
Both parties have set a time to meet with the judge in this case. This is currently pending in federal court, and they've set a meeting date to discuss what they're going to raise and when they're going to file what are called motions for summary judgment. And from what I've been reading, it seems like both parties are going to file separate motions for summary judgment. And the one thing we don't know is what exactly they're going to file on, whether or not they're going to say, you know, you have to throw out the entire suit, in the case of YouTube, whether we want you to throw out the entire suit, or we just want to address a couple of issues, or in the case of Viacom, we want you to rule totally for us, or we just want you to preclude YouTube from raising certain issues, you know, at trial or as this case goes forward.
So for our listeners who may not be as familiar with summary judgments, can someone give a brief explanation of what those entail and what might come out of them?
I think David O'Brien is our resident summary judgment, I don't want to say expert. You're the one who always states the rule most accurately when we come out to a summary judgment, so why don't you give a shot at it?
Oh, sure, I'll do my best. I don't think I qualify as an expert, though. When parties in litigation file for summary judgment, they are requesting that a particular issue of law be resolved because there are no material issues of fact that are in dispute. And what that really means is that the parties say, like, well, here, the facts are pretty clear. We all agree on the facts. We've stipulated to some extent that the facts are this, and we agree on it, but what we don't agree on is the application of law that should apply to those facts. And when they file this case, what they're requesting the judge to do then is to resolve that particular issue of law and basically completely eschew the jury trial. So there's no need for a jury because juries typically will find issues of fact and then apply the law to them. So in this case, it wouldn't be necessary because the judge could do that if the parties are agreeing on the facts.
So what questions of judgment of law do we actually have here? As my understanding is that YouTube is saying that they're protected under the DMCA, whereas Viacom is charging that YouTube has somehow been unfairly profiting from the Viacom videos that are on their site. So, I don't know. Thoughts on that, guys?
There's really no way to know what exactly they're going to bring up at summary judgment. We're going to assume that YouTube is going to say, you know, we're protected by the DMCA and the Viacom hasn't shown any facts that go against that. But, you know, other than that very broad claim, it's really difficult to see, to, you know, look into the crystal ball and try to guess what their arguments are going to be.
So the real issue in this case is really about whether or not YouTube or Google, since Google owns YouTube, can be held accountable for users of YouTube uploading infringing material to the website itself. And we've gone over this multiple times before. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act has Section 512, which is known as the Safe Harbor provision, and that will basically shield, in certain circumstances, a company like YouTube from taking on liability based on what third-party users are doing to their online service. And there are a number of provisions that you have to meet under the statute, of course, to qualify for that safe harbor. And it's been an issue of contention since at least 2005, probably a little even before then, for these new sort of Web 2.0 social media type sites where users can upload their own content to a website. What exactly what are the requirements that YouTube has to meet in order to qualify for that safe harbor and therefore not be liable for somebody else's copyright infringement?
Right.
And I think that's what I think that's what everyone expects these summary judgment motions to be about is, of course, Viacom's going to be filing for summary judgment saying, no, the DMCA does not apply here, and YouTube is going to say, yeah, we qualify because we've met all the requirements.
Right. The other thing that seems to at least crop up in the complaint is that Viacom alleges contributory and contributory infringement and inducement of copyright infringement, which, as we talked about, I think last week on the podcast, won't necessarily protect you from Digital Millennium Copyright Act liability under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
So, do we have any predictions on which way this case will go? I mean, whether the summary judgment it will rule for YouTube or Viacom.
I think it's really too early to tell. You know, a few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago now, there were these emails about a smoking gun. There was a story about how Viacom claimed to find a smoking gun in this case. But I don't see what they found as a smoking gun. They found some email saying that YouTube did know about some of these infringing files and didn't take them down. But, you know, that's just a couple of files. It's hard to tell, you know, what, if any, effect that would have on the case as a whole. I think YouTube has fairly good claims for DMCA support, but it's a big case. It's hard to tell exactly, you know, without having looked at all of the discovery, it's hard to know what they found and what's going to be brought up in these motions.
Right. So, I mean, we covered that particular story a couple months ago, I believe, and under the Section 512 requirements, this is Section 512C for meeting the safe harbor requirements, one of the key things that a company like YouTube cannot have is actual knowledge that there's infringing material that's being hosted on that online service. And what Viacom has argued in this case, at least in the past that we covered, was this this article got published, they called it like the smoking gun. Viacom uncovers all these really bad emails that apparently were going back and forth at YouTube. And some of the YouTube executives were apparently aware that people were using, repeatedly uploading infringing material. It wasn't just that an instance of like, oh, this one user uploaded it this one time. More like there are particular videos that were being uploaded that were repeatedly infringing. And the second component to this is that we have this DMCA takedown system, which is also a portion of 512. And what it does is, for a copyright holder, for a company like Viacom, there's a number of steps that they can take to issue a takedown notice to YouTube, and they have to identify a particular file or material that's been uploaded to their online service, and they also have to they have to basically warrant that they are in fact the owners, or they have the rights to enforce that particular copyright, and then they can request to take it down. And once that notice is sent to YouTube, then YouTube, in order to qualify for that safe harbor protection, then has to take it down. And so that's how those two sections tend to interplay. And so based on those emails that came out, and based on the other thing that's also interesting about this is that Viacom has argued that if they send a notice to YouTube that says, I'm not as familiar with the type of content that Viacom produces, but say that it's some TV show or something like that. If they send a notice that identifies a particular TV show and they say, we have one account on YouTube and we use it to show trailers for TV shows on this particular account, any other account that uploads anything that hosts this file is therefore infringing. It's sort of like a blanket notice saying, anyone else that's not on this one account that we own that uploads it is therefore an infringing file and it must be taken down. They've argued that that's enough to qualify for takedowns of all file versions that come up in those instances with that file name. The courts have generally said that no, that doesn't work. You can't have these blanket notices. There's been a bunch of other decisions specifically involving YouTube, if I recall correctly. There's definitely the Veo case, too, where the courts have basically said, no, you, for each individual infringing file, you're going to have to submit an individual takedown notice. So that was the other thing that was sort of at play in this, too. And I think, based on the emails that were going back and forth that we uncovered, it's hard to really tell what a judge is going to say about those and how much that's actually going to weigh into the decision. The other thing that's also been argued frequently in these cases is the types of protection measures that a company like YouTube takes to prevent repeat infringers, to identify infringing material, and how closely that they're working with a company like Viacom. And for the most part, I mean, as far as I know, YouTube has a pretty sophisticated set of software implementations that they use to identify infringing files as they get uploaded. I mean, I've heard from some people that as they upload some sort of mashup they did themselves and they queued it to some sort of copyrighted music, that those videos would either be taken down or the sound would be disabled within, you know, 10 or 15 minutes. So you have to expect that what they're doing on the back end in terms of technical stuff is pretty sophisticated. So I'd like to think that the Section 512 arguments for YouTube are pretty strong here, but it's going to be kind of too hard to tell, because we're kind of still a little bit early in the 512 litigation and how this all applies to companies like YouTube. But in a perfect world, I'd like to see that the 512 gets upheld in a positive way for YouTube too.
That's interesting. There is, I do know that there is are a number of technologies on YouTube, such as the audio fingerprinting, and I think some video fingerprinting as well, that causes the audio to be disabled, as well as have those pop-up ads that say where you can buy the music that's playing in the certain videos. So the question is, I guess, I mean, this is a case that's been brewing since 2007. And a lot of those protections have been implemented since Viacom filed this suit. So does that, or any of the other changes in the landscape of, you know, online video, change the situation for this case? In addition, you know, the existence of sites like Hulu and the other various websites where you can legally view these shows.
Well, Viacom will argue that they're still harmed by the stuff that happened before the extra protections were added in. And Hulu is different from YouTube in that Hulu only displays licensed content, and annoyingly, Hulu takes it down after a couple weeks, so you can't really catch up on an old show because it's gone after a couple weeks. You have to stay up to date.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Dominic. The fact that Hulu exists doesn't really affect the equation. The first part of what you were talking about, David, is a little more interesting. You know, is there any chance that YouTube will still be held liable for, you know, a want of proper fingerprinting technologies when this case started? My guess is no. Courts have generally held that you don't have to have the, you know, the state-of-the-art mechanisms to prevent this copyright infringement. In fact, you don't really need any mechanisms. You just need to be able to take them down when people send you takedown notices, and you need to have some sort of policy to deal with repeat infringers. You don't need to have, you know, the best available fingerprinting technology. So, you know, I don't think those arguments are going to get Viacom very far in this case.
So the last thought I had in regard to this case was in terms of their the legal filings that Viacom submitted just recently, and the fact that a large portion of them had been redacted. Any thoughts on that, guys?
Oh. I mean, there are any number of reasons why you'd want to redact something. The nature of it being redacted means I can't really even guess as to what's in them. It's probably, my guess is, if I really had to hit, yeah, something about how much money they make or some information about income or finances. Those are the things that you'd usually redact in something like this. I doubt there are any trade secrets in these documents.
I mean, documents that you file in court, for the most part, are documents of the public record, so that means that there's no one owns any copyright in them, basically, and so they can be freely distributed without anybody stopping it. So in those circumstances, when you have certain companies that, for instance, are not public companies, that do not have disclosure requirements for internal documents or internal financial information, if those are being thrust into the legal issues within filings, it's you know, it's not surprising at all that you would see heavy redaction, you know, with that type of material being submitted in those documents.
Okay, any last thoughts on this story?
I'm all set.
It's a big one. It's a big one, and we're going to have to see where this one goes, as usual, but this is one that we'll definitely keep our eye on.
All right, so our second story of the day is a case coming out of the Missouri Court of Appeals, which issued an opinion at the end of last month, where a particular woman, Victoria Major, was suing a company called Service Magic, which is a website which allows you to search around for a bunch of pre-screened contractors to do various services, work on your house, that sort of thing. And so she went through this website and inputted a lot of her contact information and got matched to the certain set of contractors, which were also named in this suit. And as it turns out, she was dissatisfied with her service. So she sued both the contractor and Service Magic in Greene County, Missouri. However, when she had submitted her contact information to make this match, she had clicked a. She had submitted the form, which said that she assented to the terms and conditions of said website. And those terms and conditions contained a forum selection clause, which said that the any cases must be brought in Denver. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so the major issue here is whether or not she did in fact accept the terms of conditions to the Service Magic website, and the method by which these terms and conditions were presented to her were what's called browse wrap. So the idea is that in click wrap, you have websites that you have to actually make some action to click that you do in fact agree to the terms and conditions. So either clicking a checkbox or clicking a button that says, I accept these terms and conditions. But Service Magic did not have click wrap. It actually just had this browse wrap technology, which says that it was a link to the terms and conditions, and that by clicking this other button, you accept the terms and conditions, but didn't actually require an action. So why is this interesting legal ground?
From what I can tell, this had never been addressed before, at least this directly by a court. And it's a bit of a strange area. So there was a case many, many years ago, back when Netscape was still relevant, where they had a browse wrap license. But what happened in that case is the browse wrap license where you'd basically, you know, click a button to download Netscape, and the browse wrap license was, you know, further down on the page where you'd actually have to scroll down. So you never saw anything about a license. You never actually saw the license until, you know, after you downloaded it, if at all. And the court held that, you know, no, you have to put the user on some sort of notice that there's, you know, a license here, and they have to be able to see it or see a link to it or, you know, click something. Just they have to have, you know, notice that there's a contract, that there are terms and conditions of the use. Now, in this case, it moved from click wraps, which many courts have held are okay, which David described earlier, to a browse wrap. Now, this is a little different than the Netflix browse wrap license in that right next to the submit button, it says, you know, by submitting, I agree to the terms and conditions, and the terms and conditions were a hyperlink. So my question is the distinction here between a click wrap, where you actually have to click I agree, and a browse wrap, in this case, what they're calling browse wrap, you know, is that big a distinction even between clicking I agree and clicking next to something that says by submitting I agree?
That's a pretty good rundown. The interesting thing I think about online contracting is evaluating it from the standpoint of how it's evolved. And absolutely correct is the fact that most places that have really key license terms are going to use click wraps these days, because and this is something that I've encountered in practice as well. This is something that most attorneys will advise their clients on, that you want to use a click wrap agreement, not a browse wrap agreement, just because it's tends to be much more clear. You encounter these all the time when you install software onto your computer. When you install Windows and stuff, you are Thrust in front of you is typically, at least, the license agreement or the end user license agreement of all the do's and do nots that, you know, revolve around your use of the software itself. And some of those interfaces will actually require you to at least scroll all the way up and down the license agreement. And it's huge. It's very dense. It's like 9-point font or something absolutely ridiculous like that. And most people do not read them. And that's the more typical way that people are presented with license terms. But in the context of browsing websites, something that we always see, or anyone always sees whenever they go to any website, is down at the bottom, for even on Google, for instance, it says terms of use. And those terms of use are at least there to be some sort of binding contract upon your use. And that's the more typical type of browse wrap that I would equate to the term browse wrap. Now, what was included within this particular case here was, at least to me, it was less like a browse wrap than I think the court made it out to be. But courts and law review articles or scholars that have written on this area have commonly indicated that people just confuse the terms all over the place. And just to try to coin a term onto a particular type of contracting mechanism. And really, we're talking about the mechanism of assent. Whether or not you have to see those terms in front of you, or a link to those terms and click OK, or whether just by way of using the website, you are binding yourself to those terms, even if you had no intention of ever clicking on the terms of use and actually reading those terms. Here, in this case, if I'm getting the facts correct, too, when she submitted the data into the website looking for the contractors, I think it was put in front of her in terms of a hyperlink that says you are agreeing to these terms. To me, that makes it much closer to a click wrap agreement, and what the court seemed to focus on was the fact that she had clear notice of the fact that there are terms that govern the use of the particular website and what happens when you submit data to it. And the court discussed in depth the SPECT case, and the SPECT case was one where it was a Netscape type program where you were installing, and you basically could install the program without ever seeing the license terms, and that's why the court in that particular case didn't enforce the license agreement there. There just wasn't sufficient notice given to the user. But in this case here, and this is how it gets differentiated, is that there was a lot of notice before the data was ever submitted to the website.
I guess the thing that shocked me about this case is that it seems like the Netscape case that came out the other way, they felt it was too much trouble to scroll down, where here, she didn't even click the link, and the judge felt that that wasn't too much trouble, which is not what I would have expected, I guess.
I think what the court was saying and what the Netflix court was saying, it's not that it's too much trouble to scroll down. It's that the person who was on the page didn't have any notice that if you scrolled down, there was something more there. I mean, I don't pay attention to whether or not there's more content on a page most of the time.
I'd say the notice would be the scroll bar, but...
That's rough,
you
Dominic.
Know, another thing is the fact that the SPECT case was heard back in 2001, so it was probably relating to events that occurred back in like the late 90s, and the internet being now, and we're in 2010, is a lot different today than it was back then, and everybody uses it, and I think a lot of people are sort of familiar that there are generally terms of use that govern use of websites, but you know, I don't know how much that really factors into the court's opinion here. I don't really recall anything specific about it.
I've been informed that I earlier said Netflix when I meant Netscape. Clearly, I just want to make that clear for the record.
Are you thinking about your Back to the Future selections that you're going to be getting on Monday?
I actually own all of Back to the Future, so no, I will not be getting those from Netflix. But I'm sorry
just
to
try uploading.
Just don't try
uploading clips to YouTube.
Send them to Dominic when you're done, by the way.
So I guess the larger question I have here is, you know, what is the minimum that it takes to actually enter a contract with someone? I'm reminded of XKCD comic number 501, where the devil goes into somebody's room and there's a sign there that says, by entering this room, you agree to forfeit your own soul rather than negotiate with the mortal residing therein. And so, I mean, would something like that be valid because there was clearly an action of entering the room and there was notice, is that sort of, I mean,
depends whether it was
obviously
noticeable notice.
First
yeah,
of all,
I mean,
great reference there. That's one of my favorite XKCD comics ever. When I was in law school, I actually wrote an extensive paper on the use of online contracting and those mechanisms. And the key thing to keep in mind is that these are contracts, and they're going to be evaluated under the same legal principles that contracting on paper in person is going to be governed under. What we're really concerned about here is, I guess, the mechanisms of consent or assent to the contract, whether or not you're agreeing to enter into some sort of binding legal agreement with another party. And what has always concerned me is not so much the notice, because I think just the norms have changed so much that people realize that there are going to be terms of use that govern the use of websites. At least I hope that they do. And I think, as you know, the internet continues to grow and there's all sorts of online services where you can create documents or upload things, that people are going to realize that there are terms that are going to affect them legally if they're going to use those services. What does concern me, though, is not so much the fact that you can get assent in that particular manner through a browser app agreement. It's more about the terms that might be included therein. And that's sort of a separate issue than the assent issue. And because of the way that the legal principles work concerning contracting, there are certain things that you simply cannot contract away. So it might be the case that in some of those browser wrap agreements on the internet, you're going to find terms that will never be enforced in a court of law. In this case, though, they certainly did enforce the form selection clause, and those are always iffy clauses. Everybody is sort of got a sort of a cocked eyebrow when it comes to form selection clauses, because they can be particularly egregious if you're a person who, say, lives in the UK and you go and visit some store that's located in California and it has a terms of service agreement on the site, which is going to, you know, function as a browser app agreement, and it has a form selection clause that says you hereby agree to, if you have any disputes under that has anything to do related to this agreement, you hereby agree to submit yourself to the California courts. And that's, there's standards that those particular form clauses will be evaluated under generally, but what I don't want to see is a court just sort of wholeheartedly say, oh, look, there's precedent out there. Now we have this case involving this contracting company, and the court in that case basically upheld browser wrapping agreements in total. So we're going to take that precedent and use it to enforce other browser wrap agreements, but we're not going to look at the terms. That's the one thing that probably concerns me about the case.
Right, and I'm going to agree with something that Dave said earlier, which was essentially that this case is a little more like a click grep, at least to me, than it is a browser.
Because of that adequate notice?
Because you had to click on something.
But you should also recognize when you sign up for like a Google account or something like that, in those cases, they make those browser app agreements function more like click wrap agreements too. But the terms are always there at the bottom of the page. But you're only going to see them if you create an account and then use some of the Google services that relate to that account. If you're just using Google, you don't have an account or anything like that, then it's a different scenario, and that's more like an actual browser app. That's another thing to point out.
So just from my own legal jargon knowledge, there was a part of the opinion that said, that cited the Service Vending Co. v. Walmart Stores forum selection case, which said that forum selection clauses apply only to contract claims and not tort claims. What exactly is a tort action? Or sorry, it said tort action. What is a tort action?
That'd be like a slip and fall.
So,
civil remedy for some sort of injury.
Yeah. So, what that particular case I believe was referring to was if you have an agreement between two people and you have a dispute about that agreement, or what the terms of that agreement are, you know, what the obligations of performance are under that agreement, then the form selection clause, should there be one in that contract, will apply. And if you're going to sue outside of that agreement of something that might not be related to the terms within the agreement, it might be more likely that you're actually filing an action in tort for some sort of civil legal injury. And therefore, the form selection clause might not apply in the contract if it doesn't have to do with the terms in that particular contract. Ben, maybe you could come up with a good example. You're always good with these great wonky examples.
So a good example would be, let's say You and I, David, let's say David O'Brien, you and I are going to on a cruise. We go on a cruise, and when we buy our tickets, it says, all claims arising out of this would have to be brought in, whatever court in Missouri court. Two things happen. One, I find myself unsatisfied by the cruise, and they lose my luggage. And while on the cruise, you break your leg because they did not swab the deck properly. My argument would be here that your tort claim could be brought anywhere, but my dissatisfaction claim would have to be brought in Missouri court.
Right, that's pretty good. So I think the critical language that they might have used in that particular case was that there had to be some sort of meaningful connection to the action that's in tort, to the contract terms themselves in order for the forum selection clause to apply. But if it's
Right,
something
and
that's
there are.
entirely independent of the contract terms, that's where you're outside of the forum selection clause.
Right, and there are other factors that would go into whether or not you could actually bring that case in, say Boston, whether or not the defendant has any substantial connection to Boston, whether or not they've done advertising in Boston. There's a whole host of things that would go through to see whether or not you could actually sue them here. But you wouldn't necessarily be bound to sue them in Missouri, wherever they had their forum selection clause.
It's a pretty complicated procedural area, as a matter of fact, and law students will spend a lot of time figuring out exactly how forms work for a period of several weeks at least. A lot of nuances to it, I guess is what I mean.
All right, so just to wrap up to make sure I understand this correctly, in the case of the XKCD comic, would that contract that he finds upon entering the room not be valid because there was no notification that outside the room to say that there is terms of service that you will agree to by entering the room? The sort of notification of notification that Dominic mentioned?
Possibly. That's a really tough analogy to apply, but I like your law school thinking here. I guess if you could analogize the room to being a website and the door of the room in particular to being some sort of field box where you're submitting data to a website, and then after upon submitting data to the website, you receive notice that would be like walking into the room. That, by the way, these terms govern all that data that you just submitted, then yeah, kind of in that case, it would be like you weren't given sufficient notice that you were going to be assenting to contractual terms, and therefore the whatever was written on that board about not being able to deal with the mortal soul that resides there inside would probably not apply. But it's tougher when you get into real world situations than it is, oh, I don't want to say it's tougher, it's just different than when you talk about real world situations and how the types of like a sign in a store for whether or not it constitutes a contract or whether or not you can have an exculpatory clause that says by entering into the store you agree not to sue the store for anything that goes wrong in there. Those types of things are generally frowned upon by courts, but it really depends on the circumstances and they're very, very fact dependent.
I find it amusing that the devil appearing in somebody's room is a quote real world example.
Mephistopheles, absolutely. I think Faust would appreciate that. Or I'm in Faust at least. We could appreciate that.
All right, any final thoughts on the story?
No, I'm all set. Dominic, Dave?
I don't think it, I mean, it's significant because it's a case that involves online contracting, but under the terms, I didn't really find it to be that significant of a legal precedent. I wasn't terribly surprised at the particular result that came out of this. But like I do said, where you have cases that have bad facts, it tends to make bad precedent. And the concern is just that this case doesn't get applied in the wrong way in other jurisdictions for the types of judges that might not understand the legal principles that are really at stake here with browse wrap agreements versus click wrap agreements.
All right, well said. And with that, we'll move on to our third story today, which I think is particularly interesting, concerning a Chinese company that has come out with a version of Ubuntu. It's called YLMFOS, and it looks just like Microsoft XP. And so not only is the interface similar looking, but it also comes with OpenOffice, which is in many ways very similar to Microsoft Office. And it also has the program Wine on it, which is a Windows emulator which allows you to run lots of different Windows-only programs.
I'm going to jump in there for a second. Wine is not an emulator.
That's true, according to the acronym.
Anyway, carry on.
And you're slightly a jerk for suggesting that, but I like it.
Me or Ben?
Ben. And I mean, the way that it works on the technical standpoint, I think it's actually loading the library files. And so that's kind of what makes it less like an emulator than other types of emulators, I guess. But yeah, for practical purposes, if you're not that familiar with the technical details, it's pretty much an emulator.
So way to call me on the technical point, Ben. Point to you. So what I think is interesting in this case is Microsoft's response. So there's a couple quotes out there from a Microsoft spokesperson that are basically saying that they're, at the moment they're not planning on pursuing any legal action against this. And if they were, it would not be so much in the software piracy domain as the intellectual property domain. So, which I think makes sense because the software piracy, it's not, I mean, they haven't stolen any of Microsoft's code. It would seem more like just their artwork and interface. So I think that's more where their intellectual property claim would come in.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So Microsoft's first look at this, it didn't look like there's any actual code pirated, so you wouldn't be able to pursue them on that. What they could do, and I think their best claim would be trademark infringement or the equivalent trade dress infringement. I don't know, copyright infringement is going to be a little tough unless they lifted exact images, which it looks like they may have actually lifted a couple of images directly out of Microsoft's. Directly from Microsoft. You may have claims on both sides.
So I think one other thing that's probably helping the YLMF people, actually the company is called Rainforest Win Guangdong Computer Technology Company. One thing that's helping them is the fact that they're not actually branding this as Windows XP. I mean, it's clear that they're promoting it as something that looks like Windows XP, but they're not actually putting it out there and saying, this is Windows XP. And in fact, if you look at the screenshots, they all have, you know, the YLMF branding on them. So do you guys think that changes the situation at all? Or
I don't think it helps them that much. The similarities between the interfaces are striking, and they are intentionally so. The risk that the thing that Microsoft is going to look at, at least if this is brought under American law, is, you know, whether or not the similarity creates a likelihood of confusion. And yes, it does. You know, a typical person who sits down at this computer is probably just going to think that it's a PC running Windows XP. They're not going to realize that it's not. And whatever faults, you know, this program may have, Microsoft's argument is going to be, you know, they're going to think that it's our computer, it's our operating system, and that it's performing poorly, you know, and that's going to hurt us. I don't know if I buy the latter part of that claim, that people, that one, Linux will perform more poorly than XP, or two, that if XP performs poorly, it will reflect, that if this performs poorly, it will reflect poorly on Microsoft. But, you know, those are essentially the claims.
The one advantage they have by not using the logo is they spare themselves the trademark claim for the logo itself. They still...
Yeah, trademark claim for the trademark, but not the trade dress claim for the rest of the operating system.
You know, a complication to this is the fact that this is a Chinese group, so I think it's more likely that you're going to have the local laws in China that would apply to this and any particular international treaty agreements that the U.S. has signed on to that, and the agreements that China has also signed on to. Those are going to be at play in determining what the choice of law is here. And so it's kind of difficult, I think, without knowing precisely off the top of my head which of those agreements that both China and the U.S. are parties to, and knowing which law then is going to apply. So, and without knowing Chinese law either, it's even more complicated for us. But I think you guys have nailed the issue here correctly. It's going to be pretty much a trade dress issue unless they have taken portions of the actual code itself in terms of the functionality anything that might actually fall into patent too, by the way. And if they're using those particular pieces of code in this new version of or this new Linux distribution, then you know those will come into play under U.S. law, and definitely the trade dress issue is going to be probably the biggest one and the most interesting one. They've definitely mocked this up to the GUI to look exactly like Windows XP, so it's kind of hard to get away from that.
Yeah,
this
I was
is a
just
pretty
checking.
Clear case of passing on.
Right. China is a WIPO country, and that stands for the World Intellectual Property Organization. I know the WIPO treaties have some have had some things to do with copyright law. I don't know if they've ever tackled trademarks in them or international trademarks. Either of you guys know? Any of you guys know?
If you had asked me about 8 months ago, I might have had a better answer than I do now, but not off the top of my head. It's been a while since I've done any international intellectual property work.
I don't know.
You got me.
That's
but
fair.
That was, you did touch on one of the bigger issues that I want to talk about is, I mean, I guess maybe Ben, you can expand a little bit more on what the WIPO treaty actually says, because it seems like China is not exactly known for being a great place to assert your copyright on things. So what protections does Microsoft have against either real Windows pirate or real versions of pirated Windows or versions like this?
I mean, China does have copyright laws similar, although I don't think identical to the ones in the United States. So if it were, you know, flat out piracy, they would have as much protection as they can get through the Chinese system, which I understand is not a lot of protection. I don't know what it is about the Chinese court system or the Chinese copyright laws, but I understand it's very difficult to prosecute people for copyright infringement, and I think furthermore it's very difficult to get any type of substantial judgment out of them, because while it's a developing country, a lot of these pirates just don't have a lot of money, which is, you know, the same problem the RIAA had in their prosecutorial efforts.
I mean, so everyone knows that a lot of counterfeited items come right out of China, and I think, to the best of my knowledge, like you're right, there are international agreements which might apply to this particular situation. But even if you spend all the time and resources to go into that country, get a judgment against the infringing people, you then now have to deal with the local government in terms of enforcing that judgment. And I really don't know a lot about this, but from little things that I've heard, I just don't think the enforcement mechanisms are strong in China at present, and that's just been like a huge concern that trumps itself up to the scale of, you know, international levels where you have multiple countries trying to create new intellectual property agreements, which, you know, actually provide some form of sanctions against countries for not enforcing those types of judgments should you get them in other countries like China.
Interestingly, one of the articles here does say that the Guangdong province, where this company is based, is one of the better provinces for intellectual property enforcement. So that could possibly help Microsoft. But if Microsoft does take this to court in China or elsewhere, what do you guys think would happen?
It's hard to know in China. In the U.S., they'd probably prevail, but they might have a heck of a time getting jurisdiction in an American court.
Yeah, my question is how much of this interface is functional? Because any part of it that was functional would defeat any type of claim that Microsoft had over either copyright or trademark or trade dress. You know, there are certainly elements of that that are functional. Unfortunately, you know, in this case, the YLMF operating system people have copied, you know, every little tiny bit of it, so it's going to... It's a tough argument to make that the entire, you know, all of the colors they picked are functional, all of the, you know, little design elements are functional, but there's at least an argument that some of this is not protectable, at least by U.S. trademark and trade dress protection.
Can you clarify what you mean by functional?
So in the U.S. system, things that are functional, things that have... I don't know how to define it other than, say, a function. So specifically when we're talking about trademarks and trade dress, anything that confers some benefit on the product, whether it makes it work better, whether it makes it less expensive to produce, that's considered a functional element. And you can't assert a trademark or a trade dress claim over that. And that's because functionality, and again, I keep on coming back to that word because I just don't know any other way to explain it. Functionality is purely a patent, the realm of the patent to cover. Likewise with a copyright. Have you guys ever, if you guys have ever seen the bike racks that look like bicycles, you can't really copyright that. So yes, there's some artistic part of it, but the shape also serves as a bike rack, so that's functional. And you can't copyright something that has function.
I think it's primarily a question of utility, whether or not the features that you're talking about have some sort of utility to them. If it, or if it's just something that basically the consumer recognizes and then can associate with a particular item. Hopefully that clarifies a little bit.
Right, and by utility, I'd say usefulness, because usefulness is just a little more common
Right.
word. People.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I suppose you could argue that certain of the color schemes or the appearance schemes in that are default in a Windows operating system might also serve to be functional to allow a computer user to identify either particular directories or particular buttons, which can accomplish some sort of function within Windows and so. Therefore, you could say that the GUI in this particular instance then is also has a lot of functionality built into it, as well as just appearances. So those are the types of things I think that a court might evaluate too. I mean, the arguments are going to be nuanced. There's going to be tons of them if it ever comes down to this, that the graphic user interface is just by that some parts of it are inherently functional, and so. It's not just for the sake of appearances. It's what
Right.
the consumer identify.
A great example of this is the fact that the close buttons, I think an XP, if not, no, not an XP, I guess it was a Vista and beyond. The close button is a red, which is definitely functional. It tells somebody who's never used the computer before, yeah, this is going to stop something.
Oh, you. I think some of the default in Win XP Home is. It has an array of buttons that pops up in front of you that says like, shut down, restart, hibernate, suspend, whatever. And those definitely have colors associated with them. And they use colors like red, for instance, when you're shutting down, so that people can equate red with, okay, you're gonna stop the computer, kind of like a stop sign.
Well, it's actually interesting thinking about the functionality part of it is that this they're actually not marking this as far as I can tell as a as sort of a clone, but actually more to help transition people from Windows to possibly an Ubuntu Linux-based system. So, I mean, could that be a proper legal argument in that the function of having it look exactly like Windows XP is that it's so that people can transition from one system to the other, and therefore, that is the function, and therefore they should be allowed to use that intellectual property.
That's a good point you're bringing up because that tells us that we probably didn't explain this very well. The functionality argument will go to whether or not Microsoft can even claim the GUI in Win XP to be protectable. So that means if there's some functionality that's built into Windows XP in the GUI, then that's going to make it unprotectable as a trade dress item. It doesn't have anything to do with the functionality of the Linux distribution then.
Yeah, and I think you can see why that would be the case, because if you allowed them to claim that t sort of functionality, I could make that claim for anything. I designed my iPod the same way as Apple has iPod to make it easier for people to move from one iPod to the other. And if you do that, you essentially get rid of the vast majority of trade dress protection.
Got it. That makes sense. Any final thoughts on this situation?
All set here.
Yeah, I'm all set.
David, did you have any?
No, I think we covered everything pretty well, but it looks like an interesting Linux distribution. It's too bad that I don't speak Chinese, so I couldn't check it out.
Well, the one other interesting bit of this is that there are actually a number of different sites you can go to just download skins for Ubuntu or other things. And we can put some links up with the podcast. One that I've used in particular is one to make Ubuntu look like Windows XP, and you can just run it on a normal Windows or a normal Ubuntu distribution. You don't have to get this particular Chinese one, and it will look the same. And then, fortunately, you can also revert back pretty easily. So we'll put those links up.
Are those desktop environments, basically?
Yeah, as far as I can tell. I mean, this one in particular is a number of different is a script that installs a number of different components so that the icons look the same, the startup looks the same. It's a number of different approaches to make it look similar.
Right, they have similar ones for OS X too, and some of them they're pretty good. I mean, anyone who's used the operating system extensively can, you know, pick up little differences, but they're pretty good.
One interesting thing that might legally distinguish between the two is what we were talking about earlier, is that if you install this yourself, you're not likely to mistake one for the other. So, if I run this script on my Ubuntu, I'm not likely to end up thinking that I'm running Windows XP. So that probably puts the people who made this stuff a little bit more in the clear, but I don't think Microsoft or Apple is pursuing that on any.
Right, so in terms of the likelihood of confusion argument, I mean, that's, you know, if under the, there's a lot of different factors that go into the likelihood of confusion analysis, but certainly a primary one would be if, for instance, these guys are marketing this as a version of Windows, and they're using, the Windows logo, and they're selling it under, some sort of version of Windows. Those things are going to factor into the separate prong under trademark law, which has to do with just trademark infringement.
The only other thing I had here was that being a Linux user myself, I can't help but wonder if this would actually help Microsoft in that if the program actually worked better, and therefore people start thinking that Microsoft actually is virus-free and has a lot fewer problems. But that's not likely to be pursued in any legal course.
Right. Unfortunately, courts have kind of taken to ignoring the fact that trademark infringement and trade dress infringement are supposed to cause harm. There are a whole bunch of cases that I could point you to where courts have gone so far as to say, yes, we think there can, yes, we think that the alleged infringing product was actually better than the project that, than the product that people were confusing it with, but we're still going to find trademark infringement and damages anyway, which is kind of weird. But
all right, with that, I think we'll wrap up this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. If you have comments, you can leave them on technicallylegal.org or leave us a comment on Twitter at TechLegal. So I'm David Liu.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
Ben Snitkoff.
And David O'Brien.
Thank you very much for listening. Have a good one. Hola y bienvenidos a Tecnomente Legales. Este es el número de podcast de 32 para el martes 12 de enero. Mi nombre es David Liu y conmigo hoy son...